in the first set of lectures, you know, we've taken this perspective that general relativity, you know, is this theory that restricts you to considering, you know, specific space times. So you have some four-dimensional manifold. You plug in the Einstein equations. If it works, that's a solution. But starting today, we want to sort of take a different perspective and think of Einstein's equations as a set of evolution equations. So that's kind of, you know, maybe how we're more used to thinking of physical theories. You know, Newtonian mechanics tells you if you take some ball, you give it, you start at some position, you give it some velocity, then it'll tell you, you know, what the trajectory of that ball is as it, you know, rises up and then, you know, falls back to the earth in a parabola. Or, you know, you could use Maxwell's equations to tell you, okay, if I start with this, you know, electromagnetic wave solution, how will it propagate? You know, though, actually, for Einstein's, sorry, for Maxwell's equations, you can divide those into evolution equations and constraint equations. And so we'll discuss how actually Einstein's equations have the same property. So for the next few days, we're going to talk about how to actually foliate a space-time manifold, that is to slice it into slices of constant time, and then this allows you to pose questions like, you know, if I start with, you know, a black hole here and a black hole here, and they're heading towards each other, then what will happen to the future as these things evolve? So the references for the material will be coming in sort of the next few lectures are going to be, so there's this section of Wald, a little bit terse, and then there's these lecture notes, the 3+1 formalism that you can find on the archive, and those go through all the details of the calculations. So, you know, our treatment will be somewhere in between the two, but if you want all the details, they're all in here. So basically for today, we're not going to really cover any physics. It's all going to be sort of geometry. We're just going to develop some, you know, mathematical technology to describe this geometry of hypersurfaces and how to take some space-time manifold and have slices of constant time and then translate geometric quantities between the four-dimensional manifold and these three-dimensional slices. But first, we're going to talk about hypersurfaces. So let's consider that we have some, you know, four-dimensional space-time manifold, and we're going to call that M. And then we're going to consider some three-dimensional manifold. And we're going to call that sigma hat. And then we're going to say we have an embedding of sigma hat and M if we have some map phi takes us from one to the other, and require that this mapping phi be one-to-one, and that with phi and its inverse are continuous. And then we're going to call sigma, which is the image of sigma hat, a hypersurface. So sort of a natural way to define a hypersurface is as the level set of some function f in this manifold M. And so by level set, I just mean for example, the way we define sigma to be all the points in M, where this function f is, for example, 0. And of course, you could choose it to be any constant. So then we can use this function f and take its gradient, and that'll give us the normal to sigma. So that's a fact we've already used several times in this class. You have some level set, the normal is you just get by taking the gradient of it. And what that means is just if you contract this normal with any vector that's tangent to sigma, then you get 0. Now we can introduce some terminology based on the character of this gradient of f. So if this vector is time-like, so that's the normal to the sigma is time-like, then we'll call sigma space-like. And this f, the gradient of f is space-like, and the opposite is true, we'll call sigma time-like. And if the gradient is null, then sigma is also null. That's just some terminology. You know, of course, you can think of, for example, you know, if we just had a Minkowski space and our level set function is just that, you know, t equals 0, then this would just have a component in the t direction, and these sigmas would just be all the, you know, the x, y, and z coordinates. So for the rest of the lecture, we're going to sort of restrict to this case where sigma is space-like. You know, the of course, the things we derive are easily generalizable to, you know, the time-like or null cases. So we can sort of choose coordinates that are locally adapted to our space-like hypersurfaces by doing the following. So throughout here, you know, A is a four-dimensional index and I is a three-dimensional index. Where here xi is going to be a coordinate in our manifold sigma hat. And in that case, sigma is just going to be we can just define sigma this way. And than our embedding. Our embedding from sigma hat to m is very simple. We have some position xi and sigma hat. Then that just goes to, basically just add a zero in the time component. And now it's a four-dimensional coordinate on m. Any questions about that so far?
But it means by that sigma being t equal to 0 is, or should we have a more general t is equal to constant or something like that? Because t is equal to, then going up.
Yeah, so I'm just saying you could choose, you can, you know, let's just say you have this manifold M, we haven't chosen coordinates yet, then, and we have this sigma, then we can basically define our coordinates in such a way that this is true. But this is certainly not the most general thing we could do. But we can, at least locally in the neighborhood of this sigma, we can choose our time coordinate there to be zero, and then choose our spatial coordinate there based on the sigma hat. But yeah, of course, it's not the most general. Yep.
Do we need word lines in this construction to define the parameter t with respect to which we define the space-like hypersurfaces, or it's just some random parameters? Do we need the word lines going from like one space-like surface to the other? And
yeah, so right now we're just talking about like a single hypersurface, and then next we'll talk about basically having this foliation, which is, you know, a set of hypersurfaces that make up the whole manifold. Is that your question, or?
Yeah, something like this. So now we just have a four-dimensional manifold with four coordinates, and we just kill one, the first one in this case, and we define this as the level set. And
yeah, so you know, right now we have this four-dimensional manifold, and we have this three-dimensional hypersurface in there. And we're just trying to, at least, in the neighborhood of this hypersurface, to introduce coordinates that sort of give this simple mapping, right? Yeah, and then we'll, after we develop a couple things for just this hypersurface, then we'll talk about foliations, where you can take the whole four-dimensional space-time manifold and write it as like a set of these hypersurfaces. Okay, so we can define a unit normal to sigma. In the following way, we just take our gradient with respect to our level set, which in this case is just t, and then we normalize it. So that it has norm minus 1. And the reason we chose this minus sign here is just so that it'll be future pointing. You can think of, you know, if we're just in Minkowski space, then if you raise this indices, then we just have minus 1, 0, 0. And if we raise it, we have 1, 0, 0 for the vector. Okay. So this embedding here tells us how to sort of carry along curves from sigma hat to m. So that means that we can also very simply carry along vectors, which would just be the tangents to the curves. So if we have some vector vi that lives in sigma hat, then you know, just by taking the gradient of the coordinate, we know that the mapping is again very similar. We just add a zero for the time component, has the same spatial components for this particular choice of coordinates. And that's technically called a push forward mapping. So now we can think about one forms. So instead of having an upper index, we'll have a downstairs index. So here we're thinking about taking some one form in our manifold M, and then technically called a pullback for pulling back this one form to sigma. And to do that, it's again very simple. We just basically take away the time coordinate. And we can see that this has to be true, basically just by considering what happens if you contract two vectors, or you know, rather contract a one form and a vector and M and sigma hat, you better get the same thing. Those are just scalars. So we can see that in M, if we have some purely so we can consider that in sigma hat, we have some purely spatial vector vi, and that will get mapped to this in M. And now we're going to contract it with a one form, ut ui. And so that will just give us vi ui and M. So now when we consider what to map the one form to here, we better get this when we contract it with vi, so there's no other option but for this to be ui. Okay, so you know, so far that seems almost very simplistic and straightforward, but just a word of caution. It's not true in general that if we have a vector and M, that we can just translate it in sigma hat to the same thing with upper indices. So this is not true in general. So we'll return a little bit how to translate vectors in M down to the hypersurface sigma hat. But before that, we do that, we can note that we can generalize this mapping that we defined here and here to tensors with any number of indices. So, for example, if we say that GAB is our metric on our four-dimensional manifold M, then that means the induced metric which I'm going to call gamma ij on sigma is really just you take the spatial components of the forward metric, and that's your induced metric. Okay, so far we've been a little bit careful to distinguish our manifold sigma hat from its image sigma and m, but from now on we're going to be a little less formal and sort of take off our hats and basically just consider the two to be the same. So now let's go back to this question about what's the right way to do this mapping of a four vector and M to sigma. So for any vector in M, you know, we can decompose it into a part that's tangent to sigma and a part that's orthogonal to sigma. And we can just do that using our normal vector. Okay, so you know, here we have this component is going to be orthogonal to sigma because that's the normal. And then this this part will be tangent. And we're gonna basically define this to be some tensor which we call gamma AB for reasons that will become clear soon. Basically, we're going to define this quantity here to be VB contracted with this gamma AB. And what that means is that this is just the Kronecker delta AB plus this combination of our unit normal. And we're going to use that later, so we'll call it star. And you know, we can check indeed that if we take any vector, say we take some vector VB, we use this projection operator, and we get some new vector given by this. If we contract that with our unit normal, then indeed we get zero. So any questions about that?
This last statement, you're saying we substitute not that expression, not the tangent expression. You're saying we substitute this one, right?
Yeah, so I'm saying if you just, we can just check here if you want. So if you do this projection, right, so we have this, and then if we plug in this thing here, then we're going to get this plus this, and then we contract this, we just get n contract with v, and then we contract na with itself, we get minus 1, and then we get 0. So that's just showing that you have some arbitrary vector, you do this projection using this guy gamma, and you get something that is indeed a tangent to your the sigma. Okay, so now we're ready to say how to take vectors from our manifold M to sigma. And that's just using this projection operator. And and we can also, now we know how to do the other missing step, which is if we have a one form defined in Sigma, we can again use this projection operator to take it to a one form and our manifold M. And in general, now we sort of know how to take any tensor with upstairs or downstairs indices from sigma to M or M to sigma just by repeating the same thing for all the indices. So let's in particular do that for our induced metric on sigma. So we said that we defined sigma just we defined the induced metric on sigma as just gamma ij, and now we're going to translate it into some four-dimensional tensor defined on M using this. And if we sort of plug in our definition there, we get the following. And we can check that this makes sense in the following way. So and just as a check, we can say if we have some vector UA that's tangent to sigma, and some other vector VA that's also tangent to sigma, then we contract those two with this expression here, then indeed then just using this fact, the last two terms go away, and we just get that. And we said before that gamma ij is the same as gij. We get the same thing if we took this contraction either just on sigma or on M using that. And we can also check if we have a different vector that's in the direction of the normal, and we contract it, then we're just going to get zero. So this sort of justifies the fact that I use this letter gamma with the upper lower index for the projector, even though I already used gamma for the induced metric, because really they are the same thing if you just raise one index. All right, everyone with me so far?
In this case, U is still tangent to, the second statement, U is still tangent to the surface.
I think here you don't have to put any restrictions on you.
Then how will it be zero? How did we get the second statement? If you put lambda in A and U is not tangent.
So plug this in.
Thank you. there is also tried UP.
Hmm?
You didn't write UP. Oh.
Yeah, well, I'm just...
Yeah,
so we get this. Messing myself up. This is the free index. Right? So this can be arbitrary. I think you can just take it away. Right? So if you just take it away, then project here, it's just lowering the index, right? Get this here, but this guy is just minus one, right? Then you get zero. Okay, good questions. Okay, so now let's discuss the curvature of this hypersurface sigma. So we can actually distinguish between two types of curvature. One that's called intrinsic curvature. It's sort of determined by de quantities just defined on sigma without considering it to be embedded in M. And then there's extrinsic curvature, which will depend on how sigma sort of lives in M. So the intrinsic curvature is very simple to define, basically using the tools we already came in knowing. So for the intrinsic curvature, basically all we have to do is take all the expressions that we know and love for our four-dimensional metric and manifold, and then translate, and then just kind of replace them with our three-dimensional metric and manifold. So, in exactly the same way that we do for the four-dimensional case, we can introduce a covariant derivative. That's compatible now it's compatible now with our induced metric sigma ij. And so we're going to use instead of a NAPA, we're going to use a D for that. So take this three-dimensional covariant derivative. You take the derivative of the metric, you get zero because it's metric compatible. And we'll also assume that it's torsion free. As in the four-dimensional case, and this is defined with some three-dimensional Christoffel symbols. And expressions for these are exactly the same as for the four-dimensional ones. But now taking derivatives with respect to this three-dimensional metric. And then once we have this, we can also define the three-dimensional Riemann tensor. And similarly, you know, we can contract this to get a three-dimensional Ricci tensor. And then contract that one more time to get the three-dimensional Ricci scalar. Okay. So okay, so we can actually check that this this covariant derivative defined that way is the same as sort of projecting the four-dimensional covariant derivative. So to write what I mean by that, we have some, you know, arbitrary tensor T here. Upstairs and downstairs indices, and then you take the four-dimensional covariant derivative.
The four-dimensional one also we are
taking. The three-dimensional covariant derivative. Then that's the same as doing this projection. Of the covariant derivative, of the four-dimensional covariant derivative, of the same thing. So basically, just taking all these indices over here and introducing projection operators on them.
So the A, B, and I, because the covariant derivative on the surface is defined only intrinsically so far. Like, what is the zero? What is the zero component of?
Yeah. So this is basically defining this, right? So in the same way that we can define these three-dimensional quantities, and then take these projection, like the vector or whatever, and take the projection operator to make them into four-dimensional quantities, we can do the same with this this covariant derivative.
Now that dA can have d0, d1, d2, d3, all four.
Yeah. So now I've written it as a Roman letter, so it can have any of the indices. So you can think of this basically the definition of this on the four-dimensional manifold, but it had better reduce to the right thing on the three-dimensional manifold. Yeah, and so just kind of check that we could check that. Defined this way, we still have metric compatibility. So, you know, if we, you know, take our induced metric, and then we, you know, we now have extended it to the four-dimensional manifold, and we've extended this to the four-dimensional manifold in the same way, we better get zero, right? Okay, so you know, with four-dimensional metric compatibility, just acting on that, we'll just give a zero. And we can see that when we act this on this guy, we'll have you know one derivative of the unit normal, but then we'll have one unit normal that's still free. And then when we contract it with these, we'll still get zero. So indeed, that is zero. So now we have sort of all these quantities that allow us to define intrinsic curvature, and now we're going to talk about the extrinsic curvature. Roughly, you can think of the extrinsic curvature as sort of measuring the bending of this hypersurface sigma as it's embedded in our manifold M.
Yeah.
All right, did I mess those up? Yeah. A, B, C, A, B, C, E, E, F, yes. Thank you. Yes. So, like if we have some our hypersurface sigma, and then if you, take some, for example, the tangent to sigma, and then you parallel transport it. Then you get some. Yeah, so let's say we parallel transport it. We get something like this. And that doesn't exactly agree with the normal at that point. We parallel transport this one to this one. And so that's kind of the rough notion of extrinsic curvature, or in equations, we're going to define this extrinsic curvature Kij to be minus covariant derivative of our unit normal. So kind of as a way to illustrate that, we can consider a cylinder that's just embedded in flat space.
So now I and J are still only spatial indices.
Yeah. So we'll use our projection operator to convert that to something in the four-dimensional manifold in a second. Yeah, but right now we're still in just spatial indices. So,
and we the spatial, and it is still the NAPA, not the covariant derivative on the induced metric or something.
Yeah. I mean, it's. I mean, I think yeah. Right now, it's just the four-dimensional covariant derivative, but just the spatial index. Yeah. So, yeah, some cylinder with a rotational axis z. So this is going to be slightly different from what we're considering because, we're considering four-dimensional space-time manifolds and three-dimensional space-like hypersurfaces. So this is some two-dimensional space-like surface that's embedded in a three-dimensional space-like surface. But it's sort of still a good illustration. So we have our cylinder. Embedded in R3. and you can think of it as the level surfaces of this row parameter, which is just the basically the cylindrical radius. So the we can calculate the Riemann tensor associated with the intrinsic curvature of the cylinder. Actually turns out to be zero. So you're kind of living on the surface of the cylinder. You don't know it's curved. But the extrinsic curvature is going to be sort of non-zero, which you can think about by parallel transporting the unit normal, how it changes as you go along the cylinder. So the unit normal to our cylinder here is just given by the following. And if we take a derivative of that, and we get the following. That's our matrix. I notice that it's symmetric. Right, so the extrinsic curvature, basically just take by taking this quantity here. And then we need to translate from our three-dimensional Cartesian coordinates to our two-dimensional coordinates on the surface of the cylinder. So here, for this case, I'm letting this I index go over I, or azimuthal radius, and z. Which is those are basically the two coordinates along sigma. Okay. And then here, A is now our three-dimensional Cartesian coordinates. And these are just the Jacobians associated with this coordinate transformation. So if you apply those transformations, you basically find that there's one non-zero component, and that's the phi phi component. And if we just plug in that we're considering a unit radius cylinder, then we just get minus one here.
Where does the minus sign come from?
Earlier, we had defined Kij as delta j and I. Napa j and I. And now what we're doing is slightly different, right?
This is just to
Okay, this is just coordinate transformation.
Yeah, it's just coordinate transformation. Yeah.
Makes sense.
Okay, so now we can return to the question of how do we take this thing defined just on sigma and extend it to a four-dimensional tensor defined on M. So we just do that in the usual way using our projection operator. And if you sort of crunch through all that, then you get the following. I'm going to use that one later too. So this quantity here, sometimes called the acceleration. As you can see that if you think of NA as like some four velocity, that would be the acceleration associated with it. So in lieu of actually crunching through that, we can just, again, check that it makes sense. So say we have some vector VB that when you can track it, the normal is 0. Then we better have, since this is a purely spatial tensor, we better have that you can track that with, if you contract that vector with k, then you get the same thing as we defined up there. And we can just very quickly check that is true because the other component is when you contract this guy with this guy, you get 0 by construction. And if we consider the opposite case, we have some vector that points in the direction of NA. We better get 0. And you can basically check that if you plug in this guy here, then the two terms will cancel out. So in a little bit, we'll give sort of a different way to think about this extrinsic curvature is actually how the intrinsic curvature changes as you go from one hypersurface to the next hypersurface. But to do that, we'll have to introduce this notion of a foliation, which is like a set of hypersurfaces.
In this check, what is the intuition we are getting? That when KB is contracted with something on parallel to sigma, then
when it's,
what do we expect? I don't see why we check this. I see that both of them are correct, but why did we check this with contraction with different vectors?
We're basically checking that if it's parallel to sigma, then we get the same thing as there, right? Because then we're just considering quantities that are just defined on sigma. We better get the same thing as if we use that one right here. And this one is checking that if we take something that's tangent to sigma, then we better get 0, because this is a purely spatial tensor. Okay, so let me just very quickly mention about foliations. So sort of the obvious generalization of this hypersurface is to consider a set of hypersurfaces that that make up all of our manifold M. We have some set of hypersurfaces parameterized by the scalar T. And together they make up this manifold M. And then obvious generalization of our level set is to now consider some level set that's equal to some value that we allow it to vary. So just to introduce some terminology, this sigma t is called a slice or a leaf. And we're going to require this e hat to have the following two properties. We want it to be smooth. And we also want its gradient not to vanish. And the reason for that is so that if we take two different slices with different values of t, we don't want them to touch at some point, which would happen if this gradient vanished at some point. And some manifold M that emits such a foliation is called globally hyperbolic. That means we can just write the whole manifold M as this set of these space-like leaves or slices.
So M is globally hyperbolic if it
has
such foliation.
Yeah, exactly.
And in this particular foliation where we keep the level set as constant T, something like that.
So it's this collection of level sets where for each T you get a level set.
So like in the earlier case, our level set was t is equal to 0.
Yeah, so that gives you one hypersurface. And now we're defining this collection of hypersurfaces where for each value of t, basically.
This t hat is a function.
Yeah, so it's some scalar function on our manifold. But the obvious choice for that would just be a function that just gives you the time coordinate if you're sort of in the adapted coordinates.
But in the previous example, means like when we were doing just one hypersurface, this t hat was just t. Means in the earlier case, level set we defined as t is equal to 0. So in that case, what was our t hat? Was just
I called it f, remember, if you recall in that case. And some f.
No, in this part, means like maybe F was before we restricted to space like hypersurfaces, right? Then, after when we restricted to space like hypersurfaces, you said sigma is all x in M such that t is equal to 0.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, so basically the thing we considered before was just a single hypersurface, and it's basically just sigma 0, right? I was just taking this and choosing one particular t.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And now we're just generalizing to this collection.
What I was confused about is, in that case, we fixed some particular t hat. Here we are keeping t hat general. In that case, the definition was x in m such that small t is equal to 0. So we had fixed our t hat to be just the time coordinate. Now you're saying this can be a general function of coordinates.
Yeah, I mean, so before I also mentioned that you know, we could just have some general F, which would
be
the same thing. And then if we're sort of, because here I haven't like fixed coordinates or whatever, but you know, once you sort of, if you kind of fix these adapted coordinates, then the obvious thing is to just make, you know, this function be the one that just picks out the time coordinate of this. Yeah. Okay, so I think we're out of time. So